Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Okay, well folks, thanks for coming along tonight, and thanks for Danny Gilbert and Gilbert and Tobin for providing this fine facility for us at this end of town. Usually we're at the other end of town, but it's great to be here at Gilbert and Tobin tonight. And it's great to have Brendan O'Connor here for his first appearance at the Sydney Institute. We meet from time to time on Sky News, and it's great to be in this kind of environment. So I was very pleased when he accepted our invitation to come along. I'll be very brief in introducing the Minister. He studied law and arts at Monash University, did a diploma in industrial relations at Harvard. He worked in the trade union movement, was elected the member for Bourke in Melbourne in 2001. After a redistribution, he became the member for Gorton in 2004, which is in the outer north-west suburbs of Melbourne. Right. He was a minister in the first Rudd government and in the first Gillard government, and of course a cabinet minister in the second Gillard government. As the minister for small business, the minister for housing and the minister for homelessness, and as I recall, this is the first time that the small business portfolio has been within the cabinet, which was widely welcomed at the time by the small business community. So it's great to have Mr. O'Connor here tonight, and he's going to talk on the topic why the Australian Labor Party is the party of small business. Thank you, Minister.
Thanks very much, Jared. It is good to be here at this the important institute. I'd like to first, of course, formally and respectfully acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which we meet, pay my respects to their elders both past and present. Also formally acknowledge Executive Director Jared Henderson and Deputy Director Anne Henderson, distinguished guests. Thank you for the invitation, Jared, to address this important forum for ideas and debate. And I'd also like to thank Danny Gilbert for his hospitality this evening. Distinguished speakers from all over the political and intellectual spectrum have valued not only the quality and diversity of debate at the Sydney Institute, but also the quality and diversity of the audience. A comment by the former High Court Justice Michael Kirby resonated with me, and I quote, "I love my Sydney Institute," he said. "It informs, irritates, upsets and stimulates me, remarkably enough, often at precisely the same time," which I thought was a very apt quote. Now, I'm not planning to irritate you, certainly not intentionally or upset you this evening, but I hope I do get to inform you insofar as the government's view on these matters of the subject of this discussion and this speech, but also to stimulate you. I want to make a single, simple argument and to explore its implications and ramifications. I want to argue this evening that the Australian Labor Party is today the natural party of small business. Some would say no easy feat. Conventional or received wisdom holds otherwise. It maintains that it is the conservative side of politics that is always the friend of business, large or small, and that everyone in politics, everyone else in politics is their enemy. Historically, it is true. That, of course, the emergence of non-Labor parties in this country was partly a response to organised Labor's parliamentary success. It was, in some ways, capital fighting back. Also, I think true is that the Liberal Party's inclination to speak to and for the middle class has been present for most of our time since Federation. As the Labor Party's natural constituency has broadened and diversified, leading to constant analysis and self-analysis of the difficulties in keeping constituencies with varying and even conflicting interests in the tent, so too the Liberal Party confronts its own identity challenges. It's certainly true that in the language that has most recently been adopted by the two main political parties in this country, The Conservatives have often outflanked the progressive side of politics in their currying of the small business constituency. The ALP has crafted its pitch around workers and community, cooperation and compassion. The Conservatives have crafted their language around business, enterprise, endeavour and entrepreneurship. And indeed, the appeal of this is clear to business people, and that has been obvious. But I would argue that Labor now does embrace enterprise and endeavour. Moreover, many of today's small businesses are what the Labor Party has taken in recent times to calling working families. Not all small businesses are family businesses, but most family businesses are small businesses. And something else has happened. Small business as a constituency has fundamentally changed since Menzies coined the phrase the forgotten people. In just over a generation, along with the opening up of our market to the world, we've seen the atomisation of our economy. We've seen an explosion of micro-businesses and small businesses performing functions once the domain of public corporations and large private companies. More than 60% of small businesses in Australia are not employers, but rather independent contractors and sole traders. The majority of these new small business people have worked as an employee, and their parents most certainly did. Many work as an employee and are also running a small business. While some commentators point out that these participants in our economy are likely to identify with the conservative side of politics, I see Labor as their natural home. Labor are more likely to defend smaller players against larger players, retail tenants rather than commercial landlords, taxi drivers rather than fleet owners, franchisees rather than franchisors. So it's against this rapidly evolving transformation of our economy that I assert that Labor is now more naturally the party of small business. Now, while I don't deny for a moment the central role of language and symbols in politics, my argument tonight involves a simple assertion about what is the most important feature of politics, and I would assert the primacy of policy. I would argue that eventually our mere words and our clever pitches as political operators are blown away by the winds of time, and in the end it is the policy settings, the impact of our actions on our constituents that should be the final criterion of who is actually the better friend of small and medium-sized enterprises in this country. So let me start by running through some of the recent history of small business policy and comparing the actual policy delivery of this government with that of its immediate predecessor. Let me take you through four policy areas to conduct, if you like, an audit of the actual actions of conservative and progressive governments. I want to consider briefly the fields of representation, taxation, fiscal policy and innovation. Let me begin with representation. Small business and specific sectors of small business have some sterling peak organisations, such as the Council of Small Business Organisations, COSPOA, the National Retailers Association, the News Agents Federation, the Pharmacy Guild, the Franchising Council and many, many more. But the Labor side of politics came to the view a long time ago that their excellent efforts just pale beside the better funded, better supported lobbying and advertising activities of the big end of town. They're also no match for organised labour. What our political system needs, it seemed to our side of politics, is what Professor Kenneth Galbraith called countervailing power, some offset, some counterbalance to the greater resources of the bigger end of town. So where this argument naturally leads is to the creation and funding of a robustly independent representational role for small business, namely a small business commissioner. Now the Conservatives in more than 11 most recent years of federal government, their so-called golden era for small business, did a deal of talking about the creation of such a role. They did not act. In fact, the first small business commissioner in Australia during the Howard years was created by the state government of Victoria in 2003, a Labor government. Last week I announced the appointment of the first federal small business commissioner. The commissioner will make direct representations to me and speak independently of me. Through the Commissioner, small business owners will be able to access information, advice and referral to services, including business advisory and dispute resolution services. There is, though, a further element of representation, and I am its embodiment. My primary role as Small Business Minister is, of course, to listen carefully to the lived experience of small business people throughout this country and to respond by enacting significant reform. But we know this truth about politics. It is very difficult to bring your concerns to the bargaining table if your feet aren't under that table. The important table, of course, is the one that's in the cabinet room. So if you conclude that we need to counterbalance the advocacy of big business and unions, it requires that the small business minister be a cabinet minister, and I am. From 2001 until they lost government, the Conservatives once again made many noises about making the small business minister a member of cabinet. Many, many words, yet no action. Also, an interesting aside, and consistent with my argument that labour and small business interests have been converging over time, is the fact that it was the Hawke government which appointed specifically this nation's first small business minister. Let me now turn to my second brief illustration, taxation. I want to compare what seems to be, from the point of view of our small business stakeholders, the pair of seminal taxation events in the last half century. For them, and for many small businesses, they happen to be the GST and the so-called carbon tax. Now, I don't want to address here arguments about global warming and the incentive effects of a market mechanism which prices carbon. Neither do I wish to assess the arguments for broadening the tax base or the desirability of giving the states a more or less assured stream of revenue, however important the merits of those two arguments are. I make this comparison of GST and carbon pricing not as a taxation expert, but as an advocate for small businesses and their interests. When the GST was introduced, it was a calamity for small business. 2 million businesses instantly became, in the words of their most vociferous peak organisation, unpaid, involuntary tax collectors for the government. The reporting requirements, the compliance costs were horrendous. They were not consulted, they were not supported, they were not compensated, they were ignored, they felt put upon, and rightly so. The Business Activity Statement, or BAS, was imposed on small business. In its early incarnations, it was a design disaster. It cost every reporting small business swathes of time. Now, I will return to the BAS later on, but I want you to understand the bruising effect of the Business Activity Statement and the GST in its application on small business in the context of the carbon tax. I report to you a true experience, repeated in many ways several times in conversations I've had with small businesses across the country over the last 6 months, particularly before July 1, I should add. I'll give you a particular example. In early June, I was talking with a businesswoman who'd been around for a while, and she was clearly scarred by the memory of the BAS debacle and leery of its repetition. She said to me, "Look, the carbon tax is coming in 3 weeks, and I still have no idea what forms I have to fill in, who I have to report to, and who I have to pay the money to." Now, I suppose that comment might be regarded as a backhanded compliment to the temporary traction which the opposition have gained in their scare campaign about carbon pricing. I was pleased, however, to be able to tell her the facts. GST and BAS were a reporting and compliance nightmare for small business, certainly originally. For the carbon price, there are no forms for small business to fill in, nobody to report to, no sums to be paid to the Australian Taxation Office or any other government department or agency. It's also, I think, worth noting as well and it was mentioned by economist Saul Eslakes recently, that the overall price impact of carbon pricing is far smaller than the price impact of GST. As we know, and so far as energy costs are concerned, it's about a 10% or just under 10% increase to small businesses. Most small businesses' average energy cost is 2% of overall cost. Therefore, there's approximately, if I can approximate, the mean average for small businesses is 0.2% of overall costs. And that, of course, is far less than the impact of the GST. I'd like to then now turn to the third issue, the size of government and the role of fiscal policy. Now, it used to be thought, and it's often claimed by the right, that the distinction between us and them, as it's coined, is that they are for small government and we are for large government. Empirically, that proposition is difficult to square with the facts, because the high point of the share of taxation in GDP in the history of our nation was during the Howard and Costello years. Or another way of putting it, that if we still had the same proportion of taxation to GDP as was at the highest point of the Howard years, we would be looking at forecasting a $24 billion surplus next year. There is a deeper and different distinction, however, between the ALP and the Coalition on this issue. I would contend that so dominant is the far right in Liberal Party politics these days that a motif of their behaviour in government is to slash frontline services, and that is exemplified all along the east coast of mainland Australia by the decisions of state governments recently. But the ALP's fundamental approach to fiscal policy and to the size of government is that it's not how big your government is, it's what you do with it that counts. And the practical differences between the left and right in Australia were thrown, I would argue, in stark relief by the global financial crisis. Now, this strangely harks back to a dispute which occupied macroeconomists in the 80s and before, the dispute between Keynesians and monetarists. It was a dispute about the effectiveness of fiscal policy, about whether changing taxation and government spending has an impact on income, investment and employment. It was, in hindsight, an infantile dispute. The Keynesians said fiscal policy worked, the monetarists said it did not. Later, macroeconomists began to ask a better, more sophisticated question. Not does it work, yes or no, but when does it work? And the macroeconomic consensus which emerged in answer to that question is that when there is a large negative economic shock which threatens to cause substantial underutilisation of labour and capital, fiscal stimulus works and is a good idea. Now, there are a smattering of extremist economists who do not agree with that consensus, but that is the consensus. So when the GFC hit, the advice from Treasury, in conformity with the consensus view, was that the only way we could avoid a deep recession was substantial and rapid fiscal stimulus. The judgment of virtually all commentators in that is that that stimulus saved tens and tens of thousands of small businesses, particularly in the construction industry, from hitting the wall. I have only to remind you of how the Coalition voted on the stimulus package to make my point about which party, in my view, is the natural representative and the better friend of small business, particularly the better friend of those businesses that would have gone under. And the Coalition on most of those decisions voted against. We had on one hand the Coalition prepared to sit on their hands for essentially, I would argue, ideological reasons and let small businesses and the economy go down the gurgler. And on the other, the ALP prepared to act rapidly, decisively and non-ideologically to use fiscal policy to buttress the economy against the most significant economic shock since the Great Depression. And I think it's also fair to say when we look at our standing now, whatever challenges our economy has, when you look at our unemployment at just over 5%, economic growth at just below 4%, contained inflation, a low debt, one-tenth the average of advanced economies insofar as the ratio of debt to GDP, I think you can contribute some of that, some of those results to the decisions made by the government to use fiscal policy effectively. As a fourth and final element of my audit of recent government policies for small business, I'd like to address innovation. I'd want to go to a particular example, the NBN. Australia has always had slow internet. Anyone who has travelled outside of Australia knows that. The NBN, of course, is remarkably fast, and I've seen it in action. What might not be immediately obvious to everybody, and certainly has been lost on our political opponents, is the benefits which the NBN brings to small business. It reduces the needs for bricks and mortar presence, cutting costs for business. It allows businesses to expand their markets and customer base. It helps them get into the supply chain. We're in the fastest growing region in the world. We have the fastest growing middle class in this region than in any other part of the world. The GDP of this region is growing faster, and by 2030 will be bigger than the United States and Europe combined. And we need that technology, and there's no doubt that small businesses, as a proportion of our exports or as part of our exports, can grow if we have the right technology. And I would argue that the NBN is a very important initiative to leverage the capacity for small businesses to grow both domestically and within the region. So I think it's possible, on the basis of these four examples, representation, taxation, fiscal policy and innovation, to argue that the Conservatives in this country in many respects have ceded their assumed mantle of being the natural party of small business. But I think it's possible to sketch a deeper philosophical underpinning for that argument, that in effect now and into the future the ALP is and will be the natural party of small business. It derives just from an honest engagement with labour values and with the lived experience of small businesses. That experience is, firstly, riven with asymmetries of bargaining power and resources. Small businesses find themselves just consistently and constantly outgunned by institutions which they must deal with. It can be characterised in this way. Banks won't always adequately support them. Their suppliers can exploit them. Their large competitors can undercut them. And the tax office... Well, the tax office and small business are not always the greatest of friends. Secondly, the experience of life in a small business is consistent with the broader trend in Western society, which economist Robert Putnam and others have demonstrated so convincingly. It is the breakdown of cooperative institutions and of social capital generating mechanisms, the atomisation of our lives. Though there are more Australians than ever before, we are more alone than ever before, more separated from each other. And this is assuredly true of the life of a small business owner. You're on your own. Now, some seek that life, the freedom of having no boss to answer to, the relief of having no deadlines or targets except self-imposed ones. But in the same way that we have to be frank about facts of go-away money, for example, we have to be frank about the multiple causes of the growth in number of micro-businesses and independent contractors in the past several decades in Australia. Some of these independent contractors and subcontractors did not embark on their business careers as volunteers. They had newfound status foisted upon them. They had their entitlements as employees stripped away and found that suddenly many more of the risks of life had been shifted to them. Now, these features of modern life, asymmetry and atomisation, surely cry out for a progressive political response. The Conservative political position, as I would posit it, is that wealth, power and risk fall where they will. This world is a ferocious dog-eat-dog contest, and there's nothing much that can or should be done about where the chips fall. Asymmetry is irrelevant and atomisation is the natural state of human beings. The progressive view is otherwise. It is that we can manage the distribution of risk in ways that are clever, efficient and fair. Let me descend then for a moment from the philosophical strata to the practicalities of this risk management task, to the practical matters of industrial relations. I want to talk briefly about the actual politics of industrial relations law in this country. I want to talk about the differences between us and the Conservatives. Generally, it's clear, at least in this parliamentary term, it's clear from what the Leader of the Opposition has said recently, that industrial relations will not be a significant issue at the next election. So bruised have the coalition been by Work Choices and by the Work Choices episode that, despite the egging on from certain quarters, it has been ruled out as a live issue in the next election. So I would contend if people seek to characterise the Liberal Party as the natural party of small business, It may well be difficult to do so on the basis of industrial relations arguments based on their own expressed undertakings only to tinker with the existing system. Now, that assertion is being questioned, and it's hard to know whether it's true or not, but if I was to rely upon the words of the opposition leader and the shadow minister for industrial relations, I'd have to contend that that is not going to be a significant point of distinction. But having said that, the Labor Party has also sought to respond to some of the issues that have been raised by small business with them. Two specific issues illustrate the practical progressive political response to industrial relations. First, on the problem of unfair dismissals, my colleague Minister Shorten is bringing forward reforms to dissuade employees from engaging in what is effectively vexatious litigation, reducing the period by which notices of unfair dismissals can be made, allowing the institution, Fair Work Australia, to dismiss matters of a vexatious nature. Now, we need to see the detail of that, but I think that is a recognition, along with what was already in place, which of course was the exemption of unfair dismissal claims by employees for the first 12 months for smaller businesses, but a recognition that we needed to make sure we had the balance right between employees and smaller businesses who were dealing with such matters. But second, on the matter of sham contracting and reclassification of workers as independent contractors, the government has recently legislated to provide further workplace protection for owner-operator drivers and for clothing outworkers who have been misclassified, we would argue, as independent contractors when they were actually simply workers. Now, it's very hard to find the arbitrary line between those points, but we are of a view, if you are an independent contractor, you are an independent contractor and you should be able to engage as such. But when you are not in any way independent, when entirely your relationship with the principal contractor is one which would be better described as an employment relationship, then that too should be recognised. And I would argue that we've found the right line there. Now, much that I've spoken about tonight is historical, recent history, it's true, but history nonetheless. I'd like to tell you a bit about the future of small business policy in Australia. I want to conclude tonight by thinking out loud about one of the perennial problems of small business policy to outline my thinking on it and to contrast that with the position of the opposition in Australia and elsewhere, and Conservatives elsewhere. The policy area is regulation and red tape. It's a mantra often heard. I make this invitation to you and I've tried it myself. Google red tape. Prepare to be monumentally bored. The stuff you will find is repetitive, hackneyed, and uninformative, not useful. It is not that the red tape issue is unimportant. It just seems to me that much of the debate goes nowhere useful very slowly. Again and again, you'll find cliches without content. There is too much red tape. We're choking on red tape. There's crushing burden of red tape. What should we do? Cut that red tape, slash it. But practically, what should we do? To that, the literature on red tape provides very few worthwhile answers. To my eye, the attitude of the conservative side of politics has verged on the comic. There is a tendency which began among more of the extreme American right-wing think tanks, or so-called think tanks, in the late 70s. They count the number of metres of shelf space which laws and regulations take up, or undertake entirely bogus counts of the number of regulations, and the only thing a Conservative need to promise is that they will make the bookcase smaller, the number of regulations fewer. Well, I do think there is a different and better and more effective approach. And the better approach derives from the basic quality of empathy which good politics requires. Put yourself in their position. Put yourself in the position of small business. And I don't mean they're worthy peak bodies and advocates. I mean the real, actual small business men and women in this country. A part of my job as small business minister, which I enjoy most, and which I think is the most useful, is to listen to small business people talk about the trials and successes of their lives and respond. And you can be inspired by those engagements, but you can also learn about what is really happening and what is the impediment to growth for those businesses if you just listen to them. And if I could dream out loud as a prosecutor of their case, I'd dream this way. Small businesses couldn't care less about the number of regulations or how much book space, a bookshelf space it requires, or anything of the sort. They care about what it costs them. They care about compliance costs for them. The dream of small business is one of escape and of release. The great American storyteller Garrison Keillor once said, "There is no prison so deadly as a life of unnecessity." And so many small businesses feel trapped in such a prison. So they dream this little dream. I have to deal with all of these government departments and agencies at all levels. Why do I have to tell them the same piece of information over and over again? Why do they use different terms for the same thing? Why do I have to have different usernames and passwords for all government websites and computer systems I have to deal with? Why doesn't government or governments make sure that all of their systems work with my accounting software? And why can't it work for the things that rile me by taking away from my business and my family the GST, the BAS, superannuation, company tax, and so on? Well, I would argue because of the efforts of this government recently, that is starting to happen, and it's called AusKey. We've counted the number of different terms used in forms for business reporting to government. There were 28,000. And the overlap and duplication was simply mind-boggling. We've cut that from 28,000 to 7,000. And you can get an AusKey now. The software companies that manufacture accounting programs are working hard to make their programs sit seamlessly on the top of the government's new streamlined computer systems. What will it mean, though, practically for the lives of small business people? Well, let me give you a single, simple, striking example. It is the GST and the business activity statement. It takes a trained accountant about 30 minutes now to complete the quarterly BAS. When these AusKey reforms are bedded in, how long will it take to produce the BAS or to pay super? 2 minutes. The significant regulatory reforms derive from a profound difference, I would argue, between the ALP and our conservative friends. The conservative approach to regulation is this: regulation is always bad, so less is always better. So it becomes perfectly legitimate just to express the policy objective in effect as cutting down bookshelf space. Our approach is different. Regulation is not good or bad, right or wrong. It is useful or useless. It is well or poorly designed. You don't improve the situation of business by unthinking deregulation. There are plenty of regulations that help small business, that foster enterprise, that protect vulnerable small businesses. There are regulations in retail tenancy law, for instance, which protect tenants from the most rapacious activities of shop owners, are ones which help small business and foster enterprise. We do not wish to abandon them. The regulations in the franchising code, which ensure that prospective franchisees are given detailed and frank information about the prospects of businesses, are ones of which we would also like to continue. So as you can see, I think it comes down to the approach you take for regulation, not indeed the notion that it's about either more or less without really going to the practical impacts on small business. So I think by some of those comparisons, whether we look at innovation, whether we're looking at fiscal policy, whether we're assessing the way in which regulation applies, I think it's fair to say that over a period of time, and as much because of the changing nature of small business, that the Labor Party has been attentive to its needs. I do say this, though, there is still a considerable way to go for governments to respond to their needs. But I think given that we have, as I say, the AusKey initiative, we have the instant asset tax write-off we announced in last budget, we have the loss carryback initiative, these are new tax reforms that very much help small business. We have the superannuation clearinghouse, which allows for businesses free of charge to have the Department of Human Services with one transaction provide the payments of superannuation payments to the respective superannuation boards. The fact that we've done that and put that in place, I think says that we have a regard and an empathy for the needs of small business. And I think that is where in the end, this issue will be determined. What practical benefits do governments provide small businesses? How do we enable small businesses to grow? What environment are we able to create to ensure that small businesses not only survive, they thrive? And it's ultimately coming down to the practical steps that have been taken. I would say that in the 11 and a half years under the previous government, there was very little attention to small business. That, in fact, the most significant reform, whilst it arguably is a good reform, and it's one that even the Labor Party at some point prior to then had advanced insofar as having a consumption tax, did not attend or was not sensitive to the regulatory impacts of that tax upon the small business constituency, and it is still felt today. So without saying much more than that, I thank you, Jared, for inviting me here today. Thank you very much for people listening, and I'm very happy to take questions. Thanks very much.
Thanks to the Minister. Thanks for the Governor Turban once again for the use of this facility. So we come to questions and discussion. We've got to no later than 7 o'clock, so we've got plenty of time. It was an important presentation tonight, for which we're grateful. You rightly identified, I guess, the key small business criticism of the Howard government was the early administration of the BAS, and I think you made some valid points about that. But as you'd be well aware from your many journeys around Australia, the principal criticism, I think, of this government turns on the unfair dismissal legislation, which Labor introduced under Paul Keating, I think, but not under Bob Hawke. I know you're making some changes, and the Minister Bill Shorten's announced some, but just taking a philosophical point, I mean, as you all know, if I employ someone and I train them for a year and after 15 months they decided to leave, I wear all the cost of their training, they go, I have no rights. But if, on the other hand, after a year I decide they should go, then they have all sorts of rights to take me down on the Industrial Relations Commission, even though we may not just get on. So is there any sort of form of thinking about a proper balance? Because until the last 20 years in Australia, the concept of some kind of right to employment only prevailed within the public sector, never prevailed in any kind of private business. So what's the kind of philosophical point about all this?
Well, I mean, it's no point in suggesting that a Labor government won't have concerns for employees, even if it's seeking to reconcile the interests of their employers. The first point, and you've just mentioned it, Jared, is that there was clearly a recognition that small business should be relieved of some of those obligations by exempting the period of time to 12 months. I think the issue itself, of course, became a focus point after Prime Minister Howard sought to exempt almost all businesses. I think, therefore, there needs to be some balance. We're going to disagree on the balance, but I welcome the fact that the Bill Shorten is looking at the way in which we remove leverage or the impacts on that sort of go-away money that's arguably been perpetuated now for some time. And so I'll be talking to him about what that will mean. I think also it would be wrong to forget the casualisation of labour in this discussion. I think that there are flexible ways in which people are employed, and indeed the growing proportion of the workforce are indeed casual employees, which does create flexibilities for employers. Sometimes I feel sympathetic to employers who either don't have the advice or the resources to get the advice to deal with employment issues, particularly smaller businesses. But I do think if you look at the way in which employers are able to either employ people on defined terms with defined durations under contracts, are able to employ people under casual arrangements where there aren't always minimum hours pursuant to any industrial instrument, I think it's fair to say that it's hard, therefore, to compare with what, you know, 30 years ago, because there has been in many respects, a change to the nature of employment because of the rise of casualisation. And I think, therefore, it's true to say that whilst there might be some employees who can become a problem after 12 months, it's also fair to say that employers will let go people before 12 months because they don't want to be burdened with a problem. So, for example, what I say to small businesses, I think you usually know after 12 months, and if you're not sure, then you can, without any response that can be legitimately made by the employee, relieve that person before that 12-month period. And I think that balance is relatively a reasonable one. But I will be looking at the detail of Minister Shorten's reform to see what else that will mean for businesses, particularly small business. And interesting too, I think, is what the opposition will do to that. I haven't heard at this point any specific distinction between the two major parties in relation to that. Now, of course, the history says otherwise, but I've yet to hear enunciated any arrangements that will distinguish both Labor and Liberal on that regard.
So there's a question there, and then we'll come here.
Yes, Minister, you've mentioned about the GFC and also the carbon tax, and many in the first stimulus they had tax deductions, and another one is the government spending, which the coalition disagrees. There are differences in philosophies in such that it's been proven that money spent and invested by people have a greater multiplier effect for growth than money spent by government. And therefore, wouldn't the carbon tax cause less growth and therefore tighter cash flow for small businesses? They're going to have less cash flow overall in the long term.
Okay, Minister.
Yeah, sure. Look, the reason why we introduced the price on carbon or with the period of carbon tax was not... its primary purpose was, of course, to reduce carbon emissions and ultimately allow the market to determine the price of carbon emissions so our economy will restructure. Now, remember, that is what we were seeking to do, moving to a carbon, a market-based approach to reducing carbon emissions, which I would say has been the approach that most... in fact, all leaders of both major parties, and at some point, including Tony Abbott, has shared in relation to how we should tackle this issue. Now, remember, it's not either do that or nothing. Tony Abbott and the opposition are suggesting what we should do instead is to use taxpayers' money to fund large polluters to change their behaviour. We don't think that's the most efficient means, and it's not the most economic approach to tackling this quite complex area of reform. And I think most commentators would agree that if you are to bring about reform in this area to seek to reduce carbon emissions, then that would be the better approach. And I finally should just say that insofar as small business is concerned, there is some cost impact, which I mentioned, so particularly in relation to energy, but it is negligible. There is no regulatory requirements and there is no direct tax requirements, and we were very mindful of trying to prevent smaller and medium enterprises getting caught up in that mechanism that we've adopted. But I would argue our reform is a better reform and a more efficient one than that being proposed by the opposition.
We're going to hear them down the back.
We were hearing from Margie Osborne the other day, and she was on about the lack of GST for online shopping beyond Australia.
Yeah.
Have you any plans to make it possible for Australian governments to collect GST and therefore level the playing field of business?
Sure. Look, online shopping is popular and increasingly so. Still the bulk of it is domestic, but increasingly not only is online shopping and retail increasing as a proportion of shopping, but overseas shopping is increasing, and it is so because of the variety of goods, and it is so because of the strength of the dollar, and it is also because of the tax-free threshold of GST of all items under $1,000. Now, we've had a Productivity Commission report arising out of that. There was an argument that whilst it would be reasonable to do so, it's an expensive exercise to the point where there would be a net loss in government revenue to bring in an arrangement that would properly police the incoming goods. Now, I don't think that's the end of the matter. I think that, and if you look across comparable countries, value, whether it's the VAT in Britain or other places, they have a lower threshold, so the tax comes in at a much earlier point. And the government is now considering what we should do, taking the evidence from the Productivity Commission, but also we set up a task force to look at the practicalities of how we would introduce a new arrangement. And the government is looking to make an announcement one way or the other on that. We are very mindful of how it's impacting on certain businesses. We're also very mindful of how popular it is amongst consumers. And reconciling those two things are not easy, but I think you will hear something possibly before Christmas on in relation to the government's response to that matter. And I get a lot of feedback and concerns about that from retail, small businesses in particular, book owners, of course, others as well. Milkshop owners.
Minister, on the subject of regulation and red tape, I think the argument can be made that despite quibbles about bastards, what quibbles about unfair dismissals, by and large, Australian small business is very comfortable with the regulation, and in fact can't get enough of regulation. And I could quote any number of examples, but probably the most topical one, which you're aware of, is the current proposal to remove licensing for commercial real estate, which has led to a furious response by the Real Estate Institute, who actually say, no, we want to keep this regulation, despite the fact that the supposed beneficiaries of the regulation, that is commercial property owners, have said we don't want it, we want out of it. So isn't that an example of the fact that realistically you've got to be very sceptical about any argument about small business, about regulation?
Well, you know, I couldn't say that without qualification. I'm not suggesting I particularly like it. I said there's good regulation, there's bad. There's badly designed prescription, and there are regulations that can foster and support businesses, and particularly small businesses that are small players in the marketplace. I mean, if we just had a laissez-faire approach to the economy, well, I don't think it would take long before some small businesses right now would find themselves in trouble, you know, if we didn't intervene to stop monopolies, etc. There are reasons to have arrangements in place. I'm aware of the matter that you've raised, and again, that's something that the government's contemplating. There are competing interests in relation to that matter, and I've listened to both sides. I guess in the end, for me, my natural inclination, given the position that I'm in, is to take the stance of the small business community. You know, obviously I want to believe it. I've always said to them, if you convince me, I'll seek to convince every other minister, particularly the Prime Minister, on a matter. And I'm, as I say, I'm weighing up the impacts of that matter now. And again, the government is at some point having to determine that issue. As you know, it's still in the process of consultation. And we'll keep considering the matter. But I think in the main, small businesses don't mind regulation. There's some that they don't like, and there's some that they understand how is in their interest.
So where would your small business regulator fit into that next year? I mean, could he have a different position to you?
Yeah, well, just in relation to the small business, the commissioner. Look, it's not a statutory body, and it's something that may go that way after the review. I mean, we're just creating it, so we don't want to start with a bureaucracy and a huge office. But I compare it with the chief science officer. It's about of the same size. We've just appointed Mark Brennan, who was the small business commissioner for 7 years in Victoria, and has got is very highly regarded amongst the business community. He will be able to speak and therefore contradict me. Now, it's not his intention to seek to contradict me. He will also be quite fearless in his commentary and advocacy on behalf of small business. Ian Chubb, who of course is the chief science officer, has spoken on matters that are not necessarily consistent with government policy. We needed to get a good person, given it doesn't have as many powers as some should argue that it should have. But I think we start there, and we'll see whether we need to provide more powers to that office. But yes, Gerard, to answer your question, this commissioner will have the capacity to speak freely and publicly on matters. And that's what separates or distinguishes him from, say, a secretary of the department.
government doing to, like, in regards to exploitation of interns?
Well, I'm an intern, mate, you know. We want to see everyone has a right to have enforced any entitlements that they have, whether it be a small business owner being able to seek relief from an unfair landlord, or whether it's indeed an employee who have rights under current legislation. I mean, the whole point of having a fair society, a society where people feel that they have access to forms of relief, is that that there are mechanisms in place for people to resolve matters. I have to say, though, in my time in industrial relations for 15 years and certainly my time as a minister and in dealing with small businesses, most matters are better dealt with outside of the legal process or certainly through a sort of dispute settling resolution than finding yourself in litigation. Litigation is not usually the place or the best path for resolution. And even when you have litigation, you may find that the relationship that you had is not better as a result of the outcome of that litigation. So usually you might want to contemplate, you know, that you might be severing that relationship if you take that path. If you're really trying to reconcile differences, then I would obviously take a much more mediative path.
So there's a question here. Okay, go be brief.
Yes, Minister, just in regards to your answers to my previous question,
sure.
You mentioned that small business will not pay the administration costs for the carbon tax. Electricity companies do not pay the administration costs to the carbon tax. They add the tax to the cost of doing business. They do not print money. They are the tax collectors. Where do you think they get the money from to pay the carbon tax administration to the government or carbon tax to the government?
That's what I said. They may, as I say, my assumption is that they'll pass on the cost, and that will occur. And I said that the most significant area will be energy costs. Look, some small businesses, and if the cost is 0.2% of overall cost, as Treasury's outlined, and in fact it's reflected in state government budgets recently as well, they've actually agreed with the Federal Treasury. Then I know that some small businesses will increase their prices of a negligible amount because the cost is not significant to overall cost. I'm not suggesting there isn't any cost, or I've never said that. We know that the bulk of the energy price increases have not come from carbon price reform. I'm not suggesting it's not an impost. It is an impost. In fact, if there was no impost on carbon, then there would be no reform to carbon emissions. And whilst we have placed an impost on the larger polluting companies, remember this, that many of the trade-exposed companies are being provided, you know, up to 94% of the impact, so that they are protected against because they are so trade-exposed. Now, this is not easy reform, and no one's suggesting that people like it, but the only way we contend you can restructure those businesses and for those businesses to understand that there is a structural disadvantage to be a high emitter is to have a mechanism in place. And I find it somewhat ironic that I'm standing here as the Labor Party or the Labor government's minister arguing for a market-based approach, and in fact I'm opposing, and I'm having to sort of contemplate that as I realise that the opposition are putting forward an approach which would mean you would tax householders and you would pay polluters to restructure. Now, it seems to me that the opposition in relation to the market has lost faith in the market. The federal government in this respect has certainly not lost faith in the market-based approach to this reform.
I think we're pretty well near the end. Have I missed anyone? Right at the back there, yeah.
One question on yesterday's announcement. I think in 2015, small business will have to go from handling the VAT four times a year to handling it 12 times. Is that a positive move in terms of handling red tape?
Well, how would you suggest that?
In having to do the company tax.
The company tax is for larger businesses.
2015, smaller ones have to do as well, I understand.
I don't think that's right. I know we've moved companies to monthly business. I mean, obviously, the payments in taxes which will have an impact on cash flow, is actually at the higher end. We know, for example, that small businesses would be impacted, and they are not covered in that area of reform that was announced by the Treasurer.
Just a final question. You've got through tonight without mentioning Tony Abbott, which is pretty good.
It's too easy.
But you did focus on the opposition, which is understandable. I mean, but is there a feeling of exasperation in senior figures of the government that you talk about the opposition a lot because you're having trouble getting what you regard as good economic message across, or is it just the way modern politics is going? Like, well, I suppose Barack Obama's talking a lot about Mitt Romney, Julia Gillard's talking a lot about Tony Abbott. I mean, what's the sort of feeling the feeling in the suburbs that you're talking to and the feeling you're getting in the cabinet? I mean, do they relate? Or?
Yeah, it's a good point. Not always. They don't always correspond. What's discussed in my electorate, for example, doesn't always correspond with what's happening in Canberra, or amongst the commentariat, or amongst the politicians. You're right. I think there's been a level of enmity. Enmity might be too strong a term, but certainly, quite a pretty tough environment at the moment politically, which I don't think ultimately is in the nation's interest. And I'd like to see an easing of that sort of tension, and people focus on policy rather than having sort of exchanging blows. I'm not sure it's entirely new. I mean, Jared, you know, you've been around for a little while. You've seen, you know, we've had a Prime Minister sacked, 40 years ago. I mean, 37 years ago. And we've seen all sorts of disruptions. And we're a very robust democracy. We recover. I deliberately left Tony Abbott out of the speech because I thought this is an august body and wants to talk about policy. And I chose to do that. I wish the Parliament actually would do that more often. Thanks.
Many thanks. I'll be brief, as I always am, and it's nearly on knock-off time at 7 o'clock. The small business community was very enthusiastic when Brendan O'Connor was named as the minister within the cabinet for the first time, and I think they've had good reason to be. And what we've found here tonight was a minister who's been considered and moderate, but argumentative and forceful with lots of things to say and lots of defences to make of the government and important initiatives to state. So we're very pleased, Minister, that you addressed us on this significant topic tonight. The paper will be published in time in the Sydney Papers online. It's being podcast and Channel 648's here from Austar and Foxtel, so it will be well recorded. And no doubt in the future you'll be back again, but for tonight, thank you and well done.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.